Welcome back to Talk Talk Nation. I'm your host, Joe Weber. And this week, sitting in the donut office right now is the one, the only, RJ De Vera. Thank you, RJ, for being with us today.
The one, the only. Wow. What do I deserve for that? What do I need to write you?
I don't know. A little plaque or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very kind. Thank you.
If you don't know RJ, he's got so many accolades to his name. Right now, you are VP of Marketing for SEMA. But you've gone through so many different job titles and so many different lives in your past. I'm really excited to dive into it.
Sure. It's 30 years of my life, roughly.
Yeah.
So I feel very blessed, very fortunate to have worked in this industry that we all love. You know, I fell in love with cars really early on, and I would say it's not the most rare, but it is rare when you find an industry that you love and you work decades in it, and you're able to find a living, right?
Definitely,
and give back to the industry that you love. So
does it feel like work still to you?
Definitely. There, you know, through the years, there's definitely been days when you're on the road 30 weekends a year. Yeah. That still feels like work. The great thing is that you get up more than 50% of the time super excited. And there's this cliche of like follow your passion. Part of that has really worked for me, but there's bits and pieces that I think you have to layer on. You know, are you good at it? Can you get paid for it? Does it provide some sort of value to someone more than yourself? I think those are the things that are important to layer on when you find your passion.
Yeah.
And if you're able to kind of, you know, find that center point through all of that, and the Japanese call it ikigai, you're very fortunate. And hopefully if that ball ever ends up in your hands, that you run with it as fast as you can and as far as you can.
Just clutch.
Yeah. Yeah. Just hold on to it.
Yeah. Well, we met a couple weeks ago when you came to have lunch here, and I think we ate lunch for like 3 hours.
It was a good lunch conversation that ended up being much longer than I think what anyone thought.
You have amazing stories and you started kind of in the tuner scene in the 90s in LA, right?
Very much so. So the story with me and car culture was always the kid that loved the Matchbox toys. You know, my mom, you know, always talks about that. Started racing RC cars, and that's how I started to tinker and fall in love with modifying. And then I had my older brother, who's 7 years older than me, was a DJ. He had some friends that I became close with. One of them took me to the LA street races, actually, when I was 14. With some guys that had fixed up Hondas, one Civic Si that was Tahitian green with SSR Superfins. Nice. I still remember that car very vividly, actually.
Yeah. The same color that like the Del Sols are often seen in?
No, I think Tahitian green was a little bit more turquoise.
Oh, okay.
And I don't remember the actual color of the Del Sol. That felt more like lime green.
Lime green or like,
And so I fell in love with cars at that time. I didn't know there were such things as import cars that could be modified. I think there was a Prelude that was with us as well. The second generation with the flip top lights also had SSR Superfins. That was like the wheel to have back then. And fell in love with car culture and this idea of modding cars. So, you know, I quit all the sports I was playing in high school and and got a job working for that same friend of my brother's at a copy service that copied medical records for life insurance. But I'd make great money. And I started to buy parts for a car I didn't have.
You were 14 years old when this happened?
I was 14 at the time, yeah.
Wow.
And going right, turning 15, so.
But you had a vision in your mind of what car you wanted to build.
It was really based on that EF Civic. It's like an 89 Civic Si. You know, I didn't grow up with a whole lot. I immigrated from the Philippines. So I was trying to not only buy parts for a car I didn't have, but I was also trying to save up for the car that I wanted, which was in my head, this EF Si Civic. And so there was a thing called the Recycler back in the day. It's basically Facebook Marketplace, but the print version from the 90s. And I started to buy mostly audio equipment because that was the big thing in the 90s.
You just run ads in the back?
It's just the want ads, newspaper thing. And then you kind of look up for like, you know, different auto parts. It wasn't just for automotive stuff. It was for lots of different things. But there was an automotive section. And a lot of the stuff you found were mostly audio equipment. There were some wheels and tires, things of that nature. So within the room that I shared with my brother was DJ equipment, and there was parts for our car I didn't have.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. So was it at the time, was the Recycler auto parts section mostly American stuff? Or has it turned to
It was JDM all stuff. Over the map. JDM did not really exist at this point in the same terms that people think of it. If you wanted to buy parts from Japan, there were maybe four shops in LA, maybe five, six. If you expanded it to LA County and Orange County, where you could actually order something, and then it would take 6 to 9 months to get, because literally it would end up in a container and they'd have to order it. And there was a few places that carried things in stock, but it was really rare, especially wheels. That was the thing that, like, you look through like photos in a book and it'd be like, ooh, SSR Neos and triple chrome, you know?
And the graininess probably hit a bunch of imperfections.
Yeah, for sure. You know, but that was the era and that's what you did. Yeah. So there were no magazines yet at that time that really focused on import car culture. You know, this is the early 90s. So the only things that you saw in print was, there was a magazine called Sport Compact Car that did mostly Euro lowrider stuff, which was, you know, a bunch of Hondas with wire wheels and like, you know, the paint jobs that look like lowrider paint, but on a Japanese car. But so you had to buy the Option magazine, and some people know what Option magazine is.
Yeah, definitely.
So you went to the Japanese market and you learned the characters for, like, I learned it for Integra, which ended up being my first car. And then you would look for it. And then you learn the chassis codes, right? Like, people know chassis codes now, you know?
So it's literally deciphering Japanese so that you can find car parts.
Exactly. And you had to take Japanese classes. There was no Google Translate, right? So you're like trying to figure out like what that really means and how to read the word exhaust or turbo timer or turbo or whatever it was. And then you tried to figure out like how you could get that particular part. Was there anyone, you know, bringing it in? Could you get a shop to contact someone from Japan to bring it in? And so it took a lot longer to do your research and figure out like what you wanted and to actually get the part, which was half the fun, to be honest.
Yeah, it's like, if I have any criticism about the internet or, you know, modern online culture, it's that things are way too easy. And so you don't get that delayed gratification of being like, I tracked this part down.
Yeah.
I contacted them. Now I have to wait a month for it to show up or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes you'd make a random call. I have a great story about a friend who wanted to get ARC for his RX-7, which is all this titanium parts, right? Yeah. Intercooler and strut bar. And so he just straight up called the number that he found.
Wow.
And just was like, hey, I want to order ARC parts for my RX-7. Is that possible? And they were like, where are you calling from? They're like, yeah, we'd have to figure out how to ship it to you, but if you're willing to pay the money. And so we went to the first import show off with this like titanium exhaust for FB RX-7 that we just kept handing to people. Like, hey, look, isn't this crazy how light it is?
It wasn't even installed. It was just
It was just in our hands. That's, you so know, funny. 'Cause there was this thought that he wanted to like sell ARC parts in the US because no one was doing, he couldn't find it.
So. Oh, so he was kind of positioning himself to be a distributor.
Yeah, initially, because he was having such a hard time. I don't think he ended up doing it. I just ended up having a booth at the first import show in the US called Import Show Off. And I just like, hey, you've got some ARC parts that you want to show people? Like, you know, I have a, like a small like 10 by 20 and a display case. Just bring the stuff over, you know?
And then you get people's contact info. Yeah. And then if they order parts, it's from you.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how I started too, is I started selling parts out of my mom's condo. you know, trying to service people in West LA, Santa Monica, if anyone knows where that is. And I promoted selling the parts like my brother promoted clubs. I just printed flyers with photos of products that I could get. And then I would put it on different, you know, import cars at Santa Monica College or UCLA or whatever.
So you would just drive around canvassing people's
pretty
cars.
Much. And that's how you promoted clubs as well. Or you would go to certain events where you knew like there'd be some modified cars. And then you just put the flyers in the windshields and waited for someone to call, hopefully.
Yeah. And did it work?
Yeah. Enough that I, you know, made enough money to modify my car. Cause a lot of it was when I ended up getting a car, when I was 16, I started modding it, but it was a new car. My mom had done some finagling that she was able to lease me a new Acura Integra, which I was super shocked about, but very grateful. But of course I started modding it, right away. And my
before mom, the lease was,
right
at came to fruition.
She actually, so my brother had an Isuzu Impulse. Anyone that knows that hopefully remembers the commercial of the guy like shooting the gun and he gets in the car and it goes faster than the bullet or something.
Some of the craziest stock wheels out of any car of the era.
Anyways, my brother wanted to be a DJ, so my mom decided to sell his car, which was giving us some problems, give him the station wagon, this Colt Vista station wagon, so he could put his speakers and turntables and go to gigs. And then she was like, well, you're going to need a car. I'm just going to lease you something safe and new, which ended up being an Acura Integra. And so I'm 15 and I'm already modding this car that's not even mine.
Yeah.
Like my mom's driving it around. And she's like, son, this car is new. Like, what are you doing? Like,
yeah, it's perfect.
It's perfect. Why would you, like, why would you replace anything? And so I kind of like, I'm going to sell the stuff, you know, as an excuse.
Yeah.
And it also helped me fund, you know, the modifications that I wanted to do. So yeah, it worked out well enough that I was able to, you know, buy parts for my car and fix it up.
Did you end up buying the car outright or did you just give it back to the dealership?
Not the first one. So unfortunately I got in an accident in in that first Integra. Ended up getting another Integra, same generation, the DA generation 91 and 93. But I really fell in love with NSX.
Yeah.
Right? NSX came out in the early 90s, 91, 92, right? And I fell in love with this idea of VTEC and this variable valve timing, which of course originated in the E30M3 through Vanos. I didn't know that. But at the time, I just loved the NSX. It was like the holy grail, like dream car of dream cars. And there was a commercial where the NSX turns into the GSR Integra.
Oh.
Because it was the first Acura and Honda that incorporated VTEC outside of the NSX. There's this 1.7 liter dual overhead cam VTEC.
Yeah.
And so I was like focused on like, that's the next car, you know?
Yeah.
And so when the other Integra, when I got an accident in it and I was able to get another car, I was like, no, I'm going to get a GSR, right? Which ended up the four headlight GSR had just been announced.
Yeah.
But I didn't like the styling of it. So I was like, I got to buy the 93 before this new one comes out.
The previous year one?
Yeah. Yeah. The DA versus the DC5?
DC2. Okay.
Was that next generation Integra, I think. So that was the next car. And that's the one I really heavily modified and I got fairly well known for. And I started my car crew with and won a bunch of awards and whatnot.
That's cool.
And that's the one that I took to the first import show off. You know, there's a line, and I know we'll talk about the Fast and Furious, where you're like, we overnight parts from Japan.
Yeah.
And for that particular show, I went to one of the stores in LA called Daz Motorsports, and I really wanted a set of SSRs, these white Type Xs. And they're like, the only way we're going to get them in time is to air freight them. So I literally like not overnighted, but air freighted these wheels from Japan just to get them for the show.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So by the age of 15, you're like already building a demo car to promote your parts you're selling. Yeah. Like every other 15-year-old at the time is playing basketball. Yeah. I don't know what was popular in the early 90s, but like you're enterprising so hard at this point.
Yes. And not because it was like a plan.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like, this is what I need to do to make money to fix up my car.
That's awesome. It's cool that you saw the path forward to do that.
There was a passion there for sure to not only fix up my car, but then to like make a living doing it.
Yeah.
And that was more actually like 16, 17 than 15. I was just buying parts.
Yeah.
And, you know, 16, 17, when I had the car was like, okay, well, maybe I can do something with this and pay not just for modding the car, but maybe, you know, to make money. Right.
Yeah. I was talking to Spike Ferriston a couple weeks ago.
Sure.
And he was saying how he, like at the time in the early 90s, was trying to hide that he was a car guy because it was seen as kind of dorky.
Okay.
Did you feel that at all? Was it dorky? Did you try to hide it at all? You're obviously like trying to show other car guys,
sure,
you know, your demo car and the parts that you have, but was it something that like people were ashamed of?
Not in my eyes, this idea that, you know, loving cars was something to hide or like being nerdy. I would say ambivalent to it. Mm-hmm. Like I just loved it so much. You know, I would see other people on the street with like another GSR and I'm like, oh my God, do you know you can get one piece headlights for that at this shop? Do you know you could get like a cold air intake and it'll sound a lot better? Like, come listen to my car.
Hell yeah.
Do
Integra guys have like a Jeep Wave or anything?
No, there wasn't anything like, there was like the Rev,
Yeah,
for sure. Like, you know, not to race, like kind of like
just like high,
like a high, you know. And I think that was with most import cars. It was, uh-huh. It was. I'm sure older people felt that it was annoying. Like, oh my god, these kids revving, which is kind of me now, which is, you know, pretty funny. Like the world comes around full circle.
Yeah.
But no, I was not ashamed of it whatsoever. In fact, I was completely the opposite. Like, yeah. And anyone that would listen, I wanted to like have their ear.
That's awesome.
Especially about Japanese imports, because it was such a, you know, kind of like a small thing at that yeah. time. There were definitely people before me who were modifying imports, but it wasn't like a huge movement yet.
It was, you know? This is pre-Fast and Furious. So
this like, is very pre-Fast and Furious.
Not mainstream yet.
Not mainstream at all. I mean, again, you know, Battle of the Imports is the first import drag racing series that really, you know, became legitimate outside of the street races. And that was in, I think, 91 or 90, 91.
And that's where like Papadakis was starting to do his civic stuff
too. Yeah, I mean, everyone in that era. So Steph and Archie and Junior and Tony and all these guys that were street racers that were looking for a path to do it professionally and, mm-hmm. and more safely. And Battle of the Imports was the first series that really gave them that opportunity. And I attended, I think I started going to Battle Imports in 93.
Okay.
And then the very first import car show, or the first two that I'm aware of in the US, happened in 1995. One was called Import Show Off, which was in March of 95. And then the other one was called the Performance Motorsports Expo, which was, I think, in August of 95. And I went to both of those. So it wasn't, to your point, it wasn't this huge movement.
Yeah. Still a pretty tight-knit community.
Yeah, still very tight-knit. Everyone kind of knew everyone. You either met each other at the Test and Tune at an eighth-mile course called Terminal Island, or the street races, or Battle of the Imports, or some house party somewhere, which was just that thing of young people getting together.
Yeah. You're not even 20 at this point. They're just starting to have these expos mm-hmm. and these conventions, and you already have a foothold as far as parts go, and like you've...
A foothold's kind. That's very kind. I was just trying to, you know, again, sell parts and make a living.
Yeah.
Some stuff, for sure, I was, you know, doing what I could to get stuff that was exclusive. Mm-hmm. So I started going to Tokyo Auto Salon the same year I started going to SEMA, which was 97. I believe I was 20 at the time.
What was SEMA like back then?
Wow, very different to what it is now, because the industry's evolved so much, not just in import car culture, but everything else. So my first year at SEMA, there was, I think, just two buildings, Center Hall and North Hall. And if you've ever been to SEMA, there's this huge outdoor area with all the semis and demos.
Yeah,
you could literally park there back in 97. Oh, there was a tent where you walked in to get your badge, and then you walked into the hall, and there was just two halls. Center and North. And now we have Center and North, South, which has two floors, and West, right? And all the parking lots are full. So way different to what it is today.
Yeah.
But even in 97, there wasn't a lot of manufacturers from Japan exhibiting at SEMA. There were a few, but very, very little, nowhere near what it is today. So it's interesting to, you know, this year would be, I think, my 29th SEMA show.
Oh, wow.
And my fourth year with the organization, right? And SEMA is really where culture and business come together. You know, there's an abbreviation or an acronym I call IPO, right? It's about innovation, passion, and opportunity. And SEMA is a great place for that. And it's always been, right? It's been about new parts and new builds. There's this passion that you know, because it's where the industry comes together, and it's where the community comes together. And then, of course, there's the opportunity part, right? From a business standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, and all the things, because it's both B2C and B2B, but it's more B2B than it is B2C, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was very different at that time. And it's been interesting to watch the evolution for the last 30 years. You know?
Yeah. Those are like the peak Chip Foose era cars, right? Like the Flames and the...
So 90s were definitely, I mean, hot rods were huge, yeah. Still are, right? But it's changed quite a bit over 30 years. I think there was and you say Chip Foose, the thing that comes to mind is a wheel line called Concept Nipper.
I've never heard of that.
So it's these, like, if you think of like cookie cutter shaped, very fluid.
Yeah.
So literally, if you look at your cookie cutter now, there would be wheels that had this like very organic shape, and it was very popular. That and the three-spoke Antera Opus One wheel was the jam, right?
90s, so that was the three-spoke era.
Yeah, it was. In Japan, it was the Super Advan and the SA3, which was a three-spoke as well. But mm-hmm. in the U.S., that Antera wheel, which was sold by CEC, was like the bee's knees, right? Yeah. It was like the thing to have. And then the Concept Nipper stuff. And then, of course, the hot rod stuff, you know, like American Racing Torque Thrust and those type of things. You know, there were very, very, very few import cars when I went to my first SEMA show in 97.
Was that kind of an unpopular corner of the convention center?
Or I don't even think it was a corner, to be honest. It was just sprinkled around.
Oh, wow.
I had started to work for a magazine called Super Street.
Oh, yeah.
Which launched in October of 96. So, you know, the fact that there was a magazine covering Japanese imports that were tuned and modified in the way that you saw it in an option magazine was only like a year old.
Were you sent from the magazine to go cover SEMA?
Partly, I would say. I wasn't super official yet. I had done the story for Tokyo Auto Salon.
Yeah.
So my first auto salon in Tokyo was January of 97. And I had met the guys at Super Street the year before, actually at Performance Motorsports Expo. And they said that we're going to do this magazine that focuses on Japanese tuning culture in the way that you guys are doing it. Because I had my car crew and we were competing at Battle of the Imports and we're going to import car shows. And the editor, Matt Pearson at the time, said, no one's covering this. And I said, yeah, it sucks. I wish someone would cover it. Uh-huh. And he's like, well, I'm going to be editor of this new magazine called Super Street. Like, I want the cover car to be one of these cars.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it was a friend. So he actually came to one of my car club meetings in my mom's condo. So there's like 30 kids in my like 1200 square foot, three bedroom condo. And Matt was, you know, he had curly hair. He was in a rock band. He was not your typical guy in the scene, but he was just there absorbing it. And he spotted my friend's Integra, very similar to mine, GSR, yellow, Racing Heart Type C's, and it was like, that's the color. Like, can we shoot that for the launch cover?
That's so cool.
So I was so excited and also jealous because I was hoping it was my car, but it made sense that it was yellow. It would pop off, you know.
So yours wasn't yellow.
Mine's was not yellow. Mine's was white.
Oh, championship white?
No, it wasn't champ white. It was whatever the white was.
Yeah.
For that generation of Integra, champ white came later when Type R came out.
Oh, okay.
So that was the initial, and I went on the photo shoot. I was so excited. I helped carry sandbags around and whatnot. And I remember I had never been to a photo shoot before, and it took the whole day. I was so shocked that it took the whole day.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the money shot was making sure that we shot at sunset, at Sweet Light, you know?
Golden hour.
And there was this idea that that they wanted where the car looked like it was like launching, like jumping, because it was the launch issue. So we ended up jacking up the car on this hill in like Angeles Crest. And it was like so sketchy.
Yeah.
Because I felt like the car might have fall off the jack stands.
It was like off kilter?
It felt like it. In the photo, it didn't look like it. But when I was out there, like, man, this feels kind of like, I hope we don't break anything, you know?
Did they just Photoshop out the jacks?
We Photoshopped the jacks out. And if you look back at that cover from Super Street, that's the launch issue. And it was my buddy's car, Mark Fata, I think he works at Longo Lexus, actually, as a sales guy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, small world.
But, I mean, did you ever have your car featured?
The car was featured later on, maybe in the next year. A lot of the cars from my crew ended up being featured in the magazine. I'd like to think we were we were pioneering some of the trends at the time from a, you know, modification standpoint. We did a lot of stuff of like colored interiors, and we were one of the teams that started like replacing lights, like Supra taillights or MR2 taillights on something that wasn't meant for.
Sure.
But yeah, you know, going to that first SEMA show, I think I just went more for myself, and the editors were going. So I don't think I covered it for the magazine, but I definitely went with them to check it out, you know?
Yeah. So was there a lot of networking going on that first time you went?
For sure. I was, you know, like anything, I didn't know what I was getting into, much like my first auto salon.
Yeah.
So I was just a kid in a candy store. I was excited to meet whoever I could meet. There were some definitely some guys in the industry that took me under their wing. That, you know, the guy that started Performance Motorsports Expo, which was an import car show, had his own. He didn't have his own. He worked for Garrett Turbochargers or Allied Signal at the time, and he was older than me, and he knew some people. And then our publisher Howard Lim at Super Street was at HKS, and then ended up at Super Street. Would introduce me to people, and so it was my first foray of like meeting industry people outside of the people that I met in Japan for Auto Salon. So yeah, I was just soaking it in, you know.
That's cool. Yeah. And how old are you at this point?
This is 97, so I'm about 20. So wow. The interesting story with that is in Vegas they wouldn't rent you a room unless you were 21.
Yeah.
So I had to ask my aunt to come with me. And so we got a room at the Tropicana, which is no longer there. And she gambled and during the day while I went to the SEMA show.
That's really sweet.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So you're working at Super Street. Yeah. Are you writing as well as taking pictures? What's your role there?
So I was basically just a contributing editor, but Matt was kind enough to put me in the masthead as editor at large. So,
oh, that's cool.
So I was writing mostly and learning to take photos, but they were decent enough to end up in print. My first article was about Tokyo Auto Salon, and I remember being at the Super Street office, which wasn't too far away from my college. I went to UCLA, and Peterson's office was down on Wilshire Boulevard, only like 15 minutes, so I would bug Matt all the time. And I was in his office, and I was like, hey, have you heard this thing called Tokyo Auto Salon? You should go. And he said, well, we don't have the budget. You know, we just started the magazine. I'm like, well, I'm going. He's like, I know. Like, can you take some photos? And I was an engineering student at the time. I was like, Matt, I'm not a photographer. He's like, it's okay. If it sucks, we won't use it. If you put it that way, sure.
Yeah.
And he's like, at least I'll pay for your film and developing. You don't have to pay for it. You know, I know you're a kind of a starving student. I said, yeah, no problem. So I went there. I borrowed a friend's pocket Leica camera, shot the show, like 7 rolls, which was crazy to me. He's like, use all the rolls. I'm like, maybe I'll shoot 2 rolls. He's like, no, use all of it. And I think it was like 7 or 9 rolls or something.
Wow.
So we came back, we developed it. He's like, yeah, these are decent enough. You know, he's like, can you write a story? And I was like, man, I'm an engineering student, not a writer.
Yeah.
He's like, RJ, that's what we have copy editors for. So I'd never worked so hard in my life on this, like maybe 1500 word.
Wow.
You know, a story. And
and
I turned it in. It was a 4-page article. And Matt was like, hey, do you want to write more articles? Because, you know, this did well. And I said, yeah, sure, why not? I got to pay my way, you know, find a way to pay my way through college. So so I did that for about 4 or 5 years.
That's awesome. Yeah. What area of engineering were you in?
I started in mechanical engineering. I didn't finish in that, oddly enough. But that's where I started school. I ended up with a sociology degree, oddly enough. I had this idea in my head that I wanted to do something with cars. And initially, it was to be a car designer. Wasn't talented enough to get into Art Center. And my drawing skills are like horrendous, like no good whatsoever. So that I knew that wasn't the path. So then the next logical path was to be an engineer.
Yeah.
And then that, for some reason, while I was in college, I figured out like, that's not what I want to do. And I kind of, through being an editor, started talking to different companies about like what they could do within the space. Our editor, Matt, you know, Super Street had this meteoric rise in terms of interest. And
you guys found the perfect void to capitalize
for on. For sure. And Matt did a great job of making it very loose and conversational and funny and entertaining. Like, that's, we made fun of ourselves all the time.
Yeah. You know? I think that when you're a scrappy startup like that, you kind of have to poke fun at yourself. You can't take yourself too seriously.
Yes.
And I feel like Option had a similar startup like that.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't trying to be the Road and Track of Japan.
Yeah.
They weren't, they're showing like, kind of an underserved part of the car community that didn't have a voice. And they were like, you know, they poked fun at stuff too. And especially in their video series, like they're making fun of each other. Yes. They're giving each other shit.
That started from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Very, very, when the editors were called the Monkey Boys. and we sent out stickers in colors that nobody wanted. You know, that was our running joke. Like, cause people would write in, let me get a Super Street sticker. Here's a sticker that you didn't, in a color you didn't want. But that's how you had fun. And I think it resonated with a lot of people. So I had a great time. I built a lot of my network through those 6 years because Matt was sending, or the staff was sending me to a ton of different events to cover. And then I started shooting feature cars as well and started to shoot like different companies in Japan and just tell their story, you know?
And this whole time you're actually shooting it, or did you have a photographer?
No, I had to learn how to shoot.
Wow.
Yeah. You just bracketed to save your life. For anyone that doesn't know, when you and this was all film, there was no digital at the time. Yeah. Bracketing is when you shoot like underexposed and overexposed.
Oh.
So you shoot like three steps down, three steps up, just to make sure like one of the shots is the right exposure, because you can't go back. Right.
Nope. I didn't know that was the word for it.
Yeah. So I took a couple of photography classes and some photojournalism classes.
Cool.
And that helped me. And then I would be an assistant to our main photographer, Wes Allison, who shot for a ton of different magazines and a ton of different OEMs. And as I was his assistant on a lot of shoots, I would learn stuff from him. So, and then I met other editors who then would teach me other things as well. So, yeah.
Checking Allstate first could save you hundreds on car insurance. Not checking if you have cash first before valeting your car? That's an amateur move. There's no worse feeling than when the valet hands you your keys and you open your wallet to see it's empty. Yeah, checking first is the right move. So check Allstate first for an auto quote. It could save you hundreds. You're in good hands with Allstate. Potential savings vary, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Allstate North American Insurance Company and Affiliates, Northbrook, Illinois.
So you're working at Super Street. Yep. You're going to Tokyo Auto Salon as well as SEMA, and you're kind of covering these beats. At what point do you get approached by the Fast and Furious people?
I was at Peterson, actually. And at that time, they had bought an import, because Peterson actually does events as well. Hot Rod Power Tour is a very famous one.
And this is like shortly after they opened, right? They opened in 94?
Who opened in 94?
Oh, are you talking about Peterson, the company?
The company.
Okay, yeah, I thought you meant the auto museum.
No, this is the publishing company.
Okay, they own Hot Rod,
they own Motor Trend, Car Craft, Super Street, all these enthusiast books. There was one on Mustangs, there was one on Chevys. They were also doing events. And so they ended up buying an import drag racing series called Naira. They hired a good friend of mine, Craig Lieberman, to be the race director. Somehow Universal found Craig. And they showed him the script to Fast and the Furious, which was called Redline at the time. And they asked him to be a consultant on it. And then they asked, hey, do you know anyone that grew up in the world of street racing culture with Japanese imports? And at the time, not only did I work for Super Street, I was also working for Naira as, I think I managed like the car show side for Naira. And he said, yeah, there's this kid that works here at Peterson. He works for me. And I'm part of his car club. So at that time I had my second car crew.
Yeah.
And Craig was part of it. It's called Art in Motion. And so Craig invited them to a car show that we were attending and competing in. And so I met a couple of the producers at that time. And Craig had told me like, hey, Universal's gonna do this film. So I met them and I remember joking with them like, I wasn't actually joking. I was just an honest question. Like, are you guys like really going to make a car with import cars? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, in my head, it was going to go straight to DVD. Like DVD was just starting to become a thing, right? I'm like, oh, this is going to be like a DVD movie. They're like, no, RJ, we're gonna put it on the big screen. And I was like, I really didn't believe them, to be quite frank. I was like, I don't know. And they're like, well, Craig's going to be a consultant. You guys are going to help choose cars for the characters and help us figure out what parts we can get. You know, it was a limited budget. So we really needed to ask like who would be willing to like give parts for free and whatnot and all these things. And
so it kind of tapped on your network.
Craig, from both Craig and I. And so, you know, I decided to jump on board, not really taking it that serious.
Yeah.
And just called all the friends like, hey, we're making this movie. And people were like, you're making this movie. And so there were definitely, you know, people like Axis Wheels, the Veilside guys in Japan, the Apex guys who were like, yeah, of course, if you guys are part of it, we'll give you some parts, right?
That's really cool.
And like, look at it now, you know, 10 movies later, 11 movies later. It's
what
crazy.
A great investment for the companies.
Yeah, I mean, it's Universal's highest grossing franchise of all time. It's like $7 billion or something crazy.
So during this process, when they're writing the script and you know, choosing the cars and stuff, they pick some really bad, there's some bad choices made, right?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I tell the story. I don't know what story Craig tells. Like we were consultants and they kind of listened to us, kind of, barely. Yeah. But we had some influence. Like in the script, I think Paul Walker's character originally went from like a 3000 GT to an Eclipse and the progression didn't feel right.
Yeah.
You know? So we're like, well, could probably start him in Eclipse and then have him end up in something like a 3000 GT, which ended up being a Supra, right?
Yeah.
So we had some influence on the different cars that people had. We didn't have as much influence on the look and feel. Mm-hmm. So my car ended up in there. It was an S2000, you know, Johnny Tran's car.
Yeah.
And it had ninja stars on it, right? And I was like, can we like profile the Asian character anymore? Like, you know, like ninja stars, like really? And then even like the graphics, which now people love, right? The robots on the cars.
But only because they're so corny. Like it's, yes. the robot, just, yeah. So who chose that?
Troy Lee designed that.
Oh man.
Yeah. They paid Troy Lee money. And I remember seeing it. And they're like, RJ, what do you think? I'm like, none of us would ever have this on our cars. but it, you know, the movie came out and it really resonated with a lot of people. Right.
Yeah.
Because it captured the essence of the culture. You know, mm-hmm. there was a lot of things wrong with the movie. You know, there were lots of lines that were wrong. And I remember I would sit in what they call dailies, right? Where they play bits and, you know, of the movie. Because I became really close with the director, Rob Cohen. And he's like, hey, come watch the dailies with us. You know, and I was like, well, that's wrong. A great example, Motec exhaust system. Paul just forgot the word and. Motec and exhaust system. So he just said, yeah, the Motec exhaust system. And I was like, well, that doesn't exist. And they were like, RJ, like, who's really going to know? I'm like, the people in my, like me.
Yeah.
And all my friends, they're like, yeah, but this isn't really meant for you and your friends. It's like, kind of it is, but it's really meant for like this young generation, right? So there's lots of things like that. Or like, yeah, you know, the spoon engines with the T66 turbos. Like, there were a lot of things like Craig and I developed. Like, oh, can you just like develop a list of terms that you guys would use? Yeah. And they would just piece it together and like, wait, where did how did this happen? And we'd catch it in the dailies. They're like, we're not reshooting that. We don't got the budget for that. So there were things like that. You know, there's 1,000 shifts in the beginning drag race that I was in, you know? But it's still, at the end of the day, it caught the essence, right?
Sure.
And it really, there were people that watched it like 7 times.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in the first week, you know, and it just blew up, right? And that's the great thing about this culture is like when you're able to like draw the bond and link through everyone, like, people embrace it, right? The SEMA show is a great example of that. You know, it's a coming together of everyone that's passionate about the industry, about the culture. And that's what this movie did as well. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Are there any lines that you just make you cringe still?
I mean, I live my life a quarter mile at a time is a very famous one. They're playing it to death right now.
Yeah.
Because it's the 25th year anniversary. Yeah. The movie's coming back to the movie theater.
What about Danger to Manifold?
Oh, yeah. That one was with the laptop.
Yeah. So
there's a great story with that one where the production crew found out that somehow a lot of us tuned the cars through a laptop, mostly on a dyno, right? There was a system called Tech 2 or DFI at the time. And there were quite a bit of people like staff and a lot of the drag racers that had this standalone ECU system that you would tune through a laptop. So they heard about it. They're like, hey, you can tune a car. You guys tune cars through a laptop, right? Like, yeah. Well, would you ever kind of do it in the car? Like, yeah, sometimes you go out for a run and you have someone in the passenger seat and they're like looking at the map and stuff.
Yeah.
And like, well, would you have it on during a race? Like, no. But is it possible? Yeah, it's possible. And so there was a lot of things like that. The four-way drag race was the same. Would you guys ever race 4 wide at the street races? Like, no. But is it possible? Ontario, which is one of the places that people street race at this time, was big enough. It was an industrial zone. And so there were a lot of things in the movie like that. And you know, Danger to Manifold was like, that doesn't really happen. They're like, we got to put something on there. I'm like, okay.
That's,
you
know, so funny.
And so a lot of that would happen. There's a weird coming back to that. I remember years later, I was watching NHRA and they did the 4 wide NHRA. Mm-hmm. And it was such an aha moment for me on how like fiction could like affect reality.
Yeah.
Cause like, where else would the 4-way NHRA drag race come from? Probably from the movie, right?
Yeah.
At some point. Cause at that point there were numerous Fast and Furious movies and there's always a 4-way drag race in the beginning.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden I'm watching like Pro Stock going 4 wide. And I think it was like Vegas or something.
Seems so dangerous.
Yeah. Pro Stock. You know, like, I was like, this is insane.
Yeah. There's a funny anecdote about, maybe Skyfall or, what's the one? The Spectre.
Okay, Bond
movie. The 007 Bond movie, where there's like a big All Saints parade in Mexico City in the beginning. And that parade did not happen in Mexico City until that movie came out.
And then it became a thing.
And then the mayor was like, we should probably do this.
So it's the same. It was it was very surreal because I instinctly remember the conversation like, would you guys race four wide? It's like, no. What, is it possible? Yeah.
That's so funny.
You know, and then all of a sudden it's like a professional thing like 8 years later.
Yeah.
You know,
that's so crazy.
Yeah, it was really fun to be part of a small part of that launching that franchise.
Did it take you by surprise when people really loved it so much?
It took everyone by surprise.
Yeah.
So the movie was originally scheduled to come out in like February or March or something. And, you know, movies get tested, right? And to see how audiences react. And the tests were coming back like Universal could not believe it. Like no one could believe how well it was testing.
Yeah.
Because you have to remember, Vin and Paul Paul had just done The Skulls and Varsity Blues. Vin had done Pitch Black. Everyone was just like up and coming actor, right? Giordano was a soap star. Michelle had basically done one indie film. And so there wasn't anyone that you were really was going to be a big draw. It was supposed to be like this popcorn, you know, teeny bopper. And it tested so well that they moved the launch date to be closer to the summer. And I think it's kind of close to where it launches now in May. Might have been April. There's always these estimates on how much a movie's going to make in the first weekend, like the gross box office. And I think Universal, and by all estimates, thought it would make $12 million.
What was the budget?
The budget was like 36.
Okay. So they were planning on losing money on this.
No, because you make it over time.
Oh, okay,
this is just the first weekend, right? And 12 would have been like a great opening weekend. It did 40.
Wow.
Right? So in one weekend, it made what it cost to move in then some. And then all of a sudden, Vin, Paul, Michelle, Giordana, they were on every late night TV show you can imagine.
Yeah.
Right? Leno, all of them. And I remember the end of the week where Paul called me and said, like, man, I gotta leave. I'm going to go surf in Southeast Asia because it's just too much attention.
Yeah.
You know? And then I was tasked to bring a lot of the news outlets to the street races.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, because they wanted to see where the story originated from, you know, and where the liberties were taken. And so I took the USA Today, the New York Times, the LA Times, basically to Ontario, just to show them what it was like.
Yeah.
So
at that point, you were so legit that you probably were not doing any street racing.
No, right? We tried to leverage the movie actually as a way to get people off the streets.
Oh, that's cool.
Honda, along with a couple other organizations, had started, and SEMA actually, I believe, was a part of it at the time, something called Racers Against Street Racing. Steph was a big face for it. Adam Sarwatari, who was a big racer. Because they're all going pro and they're all making some good money.
Yeah.
So we were all proponents of like, hey, there's opportunities not to do it on the street. And you should really think about going pro because there's a real career in it. And so the movie came out at a great time when we were already trying to do that in the background. And it really shed a light on, you know, street racing. And there were a lot of street racers that were really pissed about the movie.
Oh, really? Because
there was a lot of law enforcement clamped down on it.
Did you face any of that?
Paul, more personally? Than anyone, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Myself as well and everyone else. But we were already getting so much of it because we were on the flip side really trying to promote Racer and what Racer stood for.
So I feel like we skipped over some really fun stuff that we talked about during lunch.
Yes.
Specifically about Tokyo Auto Salon and first couple times that you went, right?
For sure. Tons of stories from Japan.
Yeah.
And seeing that car culture back in the 90s and 2000s and meeting some of these like legends, right? At least for people like me, you know, the guy that started Veilside and, you know, Top Fuel and Top Secret, Smokey Nagata. And so... Yeah. I was very lucky that I was allowed into that world, mostly because I started to help tell stories of a lot of these companies in Super Street. The first one being Veilside, who was a very prominent tuner in Japan, who knew lots of the other founders of all these other companies, like Top Secret, like Top Fuel, and a lot of the race car drivers like Tsuchiya, who is the Drift King, and Tarzan Yamada. And so I would end up at these dinners and places with all of these people. And in Japan, like the way you do business is you go out for food and drinks.
That's cool.
And then you go to karaoke and all these things. And so I have quite a few stories. I think one of the favorite ones of the group was me at a hotel across from Tokyo Auto Salon one night, you know, just sitting in the lobby because Auto Salon's held at this convention center that's like an hour and a half out from downtown Tokyo, right? And so there's nothing to do. So we're in this kind of lobby bar, for the lack of a better term. There's a vending machine of beer. And one of these tuners is this really famous GTR tuner. And he had a company called B Racing, B-E-E, big star, and like a like what looked like a Hornet B.
Yeah.
And a big R, like the GTR R. And there was a huge club in Japan called the RH9 Club, which basically meant you got a street legal GTR to run 9 seconds in the quarter mile.
Oh, wow.
And we were just in the lobby. I think John Nadari was the editor of Super Street at that time. And we were just sharing stories. And at this point, it's pretty late. And we've emptied out the vending machine of beer. And we're just asking different things. And one of the things that I always found interesting in Japan was the origin name of many companies.
Yeah. It always seems a little random.
It's very random until you ask them. So I'll start with Top Secret.
Yeah.
So Nagata-san, he actually worked at Gretti, which is a performance tuning company, yeah. right? And he wanted to start his own business on the side. And he started doing tuning on the side. And he thought it was Top Secret. So when he left and started his company, he was like, I'm just going to call it Top Secret because I started it secretly. That's really
funny. It's almost like calling your operation Skunk Works.
Yeah. There is a company called Skunk Works, right? and then like Veilside is another one where it's Yokomaku. He's the founder and creator of it, but his name translates into, I think it's like side curtain. Like Yoko is side and Maku is curtain.
Yeah.
So he was trying to do something with his name. Uh-huh. And he was like, what if I call it curtain side? He's like, well, that doesn't sound right. Well, veil is a curtain. So why don't I call it veil side?
Veil side.
And I was like, I would have never, because I was like, why is it called veil side of all things? You know,
it's one of those names where you're like, oh, that sounds so sick.
Yeah, exactly. That's
like the origin is like his name kind of
so
butchered.
Simple. Yeah, exactly. So circling back to this B Racing, I asked, I can't remember the founder's name, but that tuner, like, hey, how come your company's called B Racing? Like, do you love bees or something? And I remember he was just going around. He was looking around, it took a beat, like a long beat.
Yeah.
He's looking around, looking around, looking around. And we had stacked the beer cans up just for fun, because as we drank them, you stack them, right?
Yeah.
And he stands up and in his loudest voice, he points to the stack of beer cans and he says, I love beer. And we're all looking around and we're like, we're trying to put two and two together. A bunch of us are intoxicated. And we're like, we think he's serious. Like, he named his company after beer.
It's just B Racing is beer.
It's beer. Like, we're all thinking like, oh, like it blew our minds. And to this day, it's my favorite one, where it's like, the guy loved beer so much, he found a way to call his company beer. Under B Racing, you know,
that's great.
It was great. It was a great story. And so many memories from Japan in terms of going to Daigoku and different tuning shops and getting rides in different cars.
Yeah.
Late at night.
Like a bucket list item for so many.
And it was different at that time too, you know, and sitting in like 1,000 horsepower, like GTRs and whatnot. And I was very blessed to be able to one, just witness it and also share those stories through the magazine.
That's so cool. I'm sure that your energy came through in the story, in the pictures too, because if you're super excited to be there, you're kind of like, hobnobbing with all these people that are at the top of their industry over there. Yep. Like, your enthusiasm has to come through somehow.
It's a big part of my story. I did another podcast someone pointed it out to me. Like, whenever there's something exciting to be a part of in a movement to help grow, I'm one of the first people there.
That's awesome.
I just love helping movements and people and organizations like expand and build.
That's cool.
And so it is a huge part of, I think, what drives me mm-hmm. is like this sharing of things that I find cool. And I think that enthusiasm does show through a lot of the different things that I've done through my career. It could be the Ruja wheel line. It could be the diecast toys that I've worked on, the MTV show that I worked on.
What was the MTV show?
The MTV show was called Trick It Out. Okay. And it was this reality car competition that we shot. There was two seasons of it. I was the host and judge. It was hokey because it was MTV and it was kind of, you know, it was shot in the same time that Pimp My Ride was shot.
I bet they had zero budget.
Not that much. It was a competition where we gave two teams similar junker cars, and they had 2 weeks and like 10 grand to fix it up.
Oh my God.
And then I would come in and judge it and give them a hard time. and then the winner would keep both cars. But it was fun, you know?
Yeah.
And so there were so many projects in my life and throughout my career, even my time at McGuire's and now my time at SEMA, that it for me, it's just about helping things be bigger, be better.
Yeah.
You know, my life at SEMA's transitioned where, because it's so much about the industry, right? We're a nonprofit. All the money that we make through the shows and the membership goes back into helping protect and prolong the industry, you know, whether it's through government advocacy or product development or product distribution through some of our different services.
Yeah.
Our whole goal is to make sure that this industry survives and that, you know, it continues to succeed, right? And it prospers.
Yeah. When you hear headlines like Ford CEO is trying to limit, you know, right to repair mm-hmm. kind of stuff, how does that sit with you?
Well, I can put my personal hat on and my company hat on. Yeah. Our company hat is pro-choice, right? In terms of consumer choice. We've been very big in a lot of advocacy to keep things open and for people to have the choice to choose what they drive.
Yeah.
So, you know, right to repair, we have something called right to modify, which is kind of the next level. And our goal is to make sure that aftermarket brands continue to have an opportunity to have access. So yeah. ADOS is a great example. It's going to be mandatory, right? I think in 2030.
That's the scanning system.
So ADOS is all the systems within your car that help it be safe.
Yeah.
So, you know, parking sensors, lane departure, all the radar things and whatnot. And so there are OEMs that are trying to close that down. And for us, we're trying to make sure that keeps open so that if a company develops a lift kit, the system can be recalibrated to that lift kit or if you lower it or whatever the case may be.
More like open source for everyone.
Yes, because if it's closed, then you can't recalibrate it.
Yeah.
Right. And so then it becomes like, well, what happens to the ADOS system? Does the car start to think wacky things because it's not where it was from factory, right? Because it's been modified or accessorized. You know, if you put a winch and it blocks the sensor, like how do you recalibrate that, right? So there's many things that we as an association are fighting for from a legislative standpoint to make sure the laws help our manufacturers still develop product safely, you know, for the end customer who wants to continue to customize and modify their vehicles. So
yeah.
So my personal hat, it doesn't sit well, of course. Like it's, you know, we should all be allowed the opportunity to customize our vehicles that make sense for us as enthusiasts, right? So
as an owner of an Audi, mm-hmm. I really hate that I can't even, do an oil change.
It's becoming more and more difficult.
Yeah.
Right. To do anything, you know, whether it's maintenance or modification. And that's, again, for us, our goal is just to make sure those lanes stay open so that manufacturers can continue to make products to customize, to modify.
That's awesome.
So that people like you and me can continue to personalize our vehicles and make them our own and not just some, you know, white box on four wheels.
In an era where every car is basically the same,
yes,
it's super important that we're able to do that kind of stuff.
It's where the aftermarket industry is rooted in. It's where my love comes from. Like I was putting parts, new parts on a new car that didn't need it.
Yeah.
Right? Before I even had my license. And that made that car very personal to me. It became an extension of who I was, right? Yeah. And I think for many enthusiasts, that's such a big part of car ownership, you know, and especially if you're more on the aftermarket side where you're adding a custom set of wheels or a different wing or a performance adder or you name whatever the accessory is, right? Or you're lifting it and you're putting like, you know, all terrain or you know, mud terrain tires mm-hmm. or whatever the case may be, or you're slamming it and you're putting Bozuzoku like exhaust pipes on it. So that's, I mean, for me, it's why I joined the association, right? To be a part of, you know, that organization that helps to try to protect that.
Yeah. You guys recently went through a name change, right?
SEMA?
Yeah, a couple of years ago. You maybe it was before your time.
It was much before my time because it was originally Speed Equipment Manufacturers Association, I believe.
And then you took the speed out of it, right? Just because
it was much more than just... So yeah. SEMA got started by a bunch of guys drag racing.
Yeah.
The story is, I think someone that was doing licensing or some sort of lawyer told them, you know, you'd have a lot more power if you came together as a group.
Yeah.
And so the original guys like Ed O'Brock and Mr. Gasket and Wally Parks from the NHRA, they formed SEMA. And so much
wasn't
of it...
Wasn't Robert Peterson part of that
crew? I think Robert Peterson was part of that crew as well. And so much of it was much more around speed equipment. Where it's evolved to specialty equipment. Because it's so much more broad than just the racing and performance side of the industry, right? There's the off-road side, there's the collision side, there's the audio side, there's the restyling, like the vehicle wraps and PPF and ceramic coat side. So there's all these elements that are much more than speed. And that's I usually know most of my facts. I don't know when that transition of the name happened. Yeah. I think it was in the 80s, actually.
Oh, that long
ago. But I'd have to look and double check, but it's not recent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is extremely diverse. It took me forever to go to my first one, mm-hmm. but first time I went to SEMA was last year.
Right.
And I came in through the side that was just, you know, like transmissions and subframes and... Okay. The parts.
Sure.
And I was like, oh shit, I'm in the wrong spot. Yeah. And then I got, you know, I had to get to the Hankook booth pretty fast.
Right.
And I was just like enamored. I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. Like even just looking you know, axles and differentials and stuff. I'm like, this is so cool to have this amount of diversity in one place. And I was only in a corner of one of the convention centers.
Yeah, one. I mean, there's four buildings, right?
Yeah.
And really five, if you think one building has two floors. And there's over 2,300 to 2,400 exhibitors. So, you know, in terms of fun facts, we actually lay down 23 miles of aisle carpet.
Wow.
So if you walked every aisle at the SEMA show, you almost did a marathon. Holy crap. And that's just inside. That's not even crazy. Outside. So it is a kid. You're like a kid in a candy store.
Yeah.
It takes all 4 days to get through it if you really want to. You know, it's a great event. It is the coming together of the industry of like culture and commerce. And now it's open to the public on Friday. So there is an opportunity really cool. for people to come. We've got the open to the public experience that's capped by a music festival, a motorsports and music very festival cool. Friday night. So that's fairly new for us, only a couple years. So the show continues to evolve and expand. Our VP of events, Tom, likes to say that we're just a reflection of the industry. And, you know, I 100% believe that that's what the show is, you know, and as the industry evolves, from when I started going in 97 with two buildings to what it is now, 30 years later, you know, in like, I think it's 1.3 million square foot of exhibit space and over 3 million square foot of just space alone.
Wow.
It's just much bigger than it's ever been. And it's a good marker for the industry because the industry continues to grow.
And then there's also a part that I didn't even get to, mm-hmm. which is a totally different acronym that is escaping me right now, but that's on the other side of Las Vegas.
The Apex show is not our event.
Okay.
It's held in conjunction with ours. They're semi related. That's the one that's more about repair and replacement. And that's done by a different association.
Yeah.
That's much more on that repair and replacement side. So more OEM, I would say.
We'll say it's the more boring side. So don't go to that.
That's not fair. That's not fair. The badge that gets you into SEMA gets you into Apex.
Okay.
And the Apex badge gets you into SEMA. Oh, okay. So we do have a tied relationship, and it is all about the automotive industry and all boats rise on a rising tide. So it's a great week to be in Vegas for sure. And then F1's right after.
I was going to say, it was like a little hectic because it was hard to navigate around all the street blockages, but it was also very exciting to be like, oh shit, there's going to be an F1 race the next week.
It's a great week and it's a great month in Vegas because it kind of kicks off with, I think, the NHRA event right before us. Yeah. And then the Wynn Concours, the Las Vegas Concours.
Yeah, that was really cool last year.
And then us, and then the F1 event. So if you think about like a car month in a city, that's a city that has a lot going on for the month of November.
I was really surprised at how easy it was to get around with like the maglev train.
Sure.
And Ubers were pretty cheap at the time, and
the city does a great job. There's now the Tesla tunnels or the Boring Company tunnel. I think it's the monorail versus maglev. Maglev would be amazing. That's the train that would go from LA to Vegas in some crazy.
The super fast one. Okay, I'm wrong on that.
Because I think they're testing maglev in Japan.
Oh,
which
sick.
I'm like super curious to see, like, because it's supposed it can go like 400 miles an hour. Tangent, yeah. But I like love technology, as you can tell. But it's busy.
Yeah.
But you can get around. There's always tricks. Everyone's got their little trick, and cheat codes.
Yeah.
But it's such a great event to come to because of the energy that comes from the event and the business that's done, and you see it all firsthand. You know, whether you're an enthusiast, whether you're into industry, it's just a great like coming together.
Definitely.
Regardless of what you're trying to do, right? It might be a business thing. It might just be you're a fan of the culture and you want to be part of the movement. But it's, there's 160,000 plus people that come, right?
Wow.
So it's a huge coming together.
That is huge.
Of all things automotive. So
hell yeah. Well, SEMA was so fun last year. I can't wait for this year.
And we've got a few things cooking, right?
Yeah, yeah. We got some things cooking.
We have some things cooking.
I'm super excited for November. And if you've never been to SEMA, try to get there this year. RJ, thank you so much for joining me on Talk Nation. And thank you for listening. If people want to follow you on Instagram, what's your handle?
RJ_DeVera. I'm not very social on social media these days, but I'm still there. I do post everything that I post about is about cars. So
hell yeah.
If you like that type of stuff.
Do you have any pictures of your old Integra?
There are some on my wall. It's probably ways back. I like everyone else during the pandemic, you started to do the look back.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my pandemic content is a lot of the look back things. A lot of the cars that I built for different companies and my Integra is on there. So
awesome. Well, if you're a fan of Super Street or SEMA or Meguiar's, RJ is the dude. So I already did my... outro.
Extra outro.
Thank you so much for watching. Watch every other week, Talk Nation. And if you're not watching this, watch Jimmy Eats Cars. And we'll see you next time. Bye.